Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career. All right, welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg, and Carl Carlson's on the line. Hey, Carl.
Fred.
Hey, you know, in our last episode, we talked about when to do an FMEA and kind of gave that idea that they're not always the right thing to do. But sometimes they are, and you need a way to decide when and what to do, when to do an FMEA. And we also spent a little bit of time talking about why FMEAs have such a bad rap in some circles. I was referring to the moans I hear sometimes when I mention FMEAs. But one of the questions that comes up that I've heard a number of different times, and I've seen it in technical papers, is somebody will say, well, just multiplying severity and occurrence and detection is not really useful. It, you know, they should be added, or they should be weighted, or you should put a distribution on those things, or they make it this huge convoluted, you know. And I look at all those things and go, is that more trouble than it's worth? Are they missing what the RPN, the risk priority number of an FMEA, is all about? And one of the things I come out at, Carl, is that the engineers love to have a number. If we give it a scale of 1 to 10 and somebody says 7 and somebody else says 5, they'll talk about it all day long. Why it's a 5 and why it's a 7, and talk all day long about what we know and don't know and the technical details, and argue back and forth why it should be a particular score. You know, the actual score doesn't really matter. The discussion about it does. You know, I find that the FMEAs oftentimes have the most value is when the team talks about what the issues are and gets alignment about, oh, hey, we need to solve some of these issues. And the actual score at the end of the day is pretty meaningless. You know, is it a 617 RPN or was it a 412? You know, if it's the one that we want to go solve, then it was valuable.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, yeah. Is there really something behind RPNs, or is some of these academic papers onto something there, or is that, or are RPNs just a vehicle to get something else done?
Yeah, let me see if I can frame this. This is a great lead-in, Fred, and a good conversation to have over a cup of coffee. I was involved in the original AIAG FMEA discussion.
I remember that. It was like, yeah. Thou shalt use this fixed scale so that we can roll it up at vehicle mm-hmm. levels. And I'm like, what? Really? Oh, come on.
And so I was involved in some of the standards, SAE standard, and I've been teaching this for years and years. So here's kind of a backdrop. The discussion is the most important thing. I agree completely. You want to discuss the risk. You want to discuss failures and causes and understand where the risk is. And then you want to go about improving the design. That's the primary objective of an FMEA, is to improve the design mm-hmm. of the product or process if you're doing a PFMEA. And you don't want to lose sight of that. So we want to get at where the problems are, what the cause of those problems are, and how we're going to fix them. Now, then in the real world, we have limited resources. And so it becomes useful to prioritize risk. And therein is the entire purpose of RPNs and the use of severity, occurrence, and sometimes detection, is to prioritize risk within a given FMEA. What does not add value is to consider this risk as purely objective, because it isn't, It has some degree of subjectivity to it because you're introducing a new product or you're developing a new product. So you can't be purely objective on some of these risk criteria. So there is some degree of subjectivity.
Now, Carl, when you're talking about objective, I've run into some teams when they go to occurrence, is they want to look up failure rates for the different failure mechanisms or modes, or they want to go find actual field data that gives them failure rate information, or they want to look it up in a table someplace and put actual numbers. And I'm like, no, this is a rank ordering of this room's understanding of those things. And it's not a fixed number.
Right. I would consider the field data as input to a decision on the rank order of occurrence. So you have a failure mode and cause, and of course we have to, a whole different discussion, and it's very worthy of having on SOR, is the occurrence of the cause of failure, or is it the occurrence of the failure mode? And so I want to have that discussion sometime, but let's set that aside, because that'll take some time. And there is a right way and a wrong way to do it. And then let's talk about how do you come to that scale ranking? So how do you get to a 6? And it's okay to have criteria that relates to objectivity. You can have a criteria for a 5 or a 6 that has a certain failure rate, but that's input to the discussion. Because the failure rate in the field is not exactly the same as the anticipated failure rate for your new system.
Well, one of the things I've run into is you get going on an FMEA and we say we got 20, 30, 40 things listed and we're timed to score the severity. And everything's a 6. Everything's not a major disaster and everything it interrupts the functionality of the system. And it kind of... Everything is on a standard scale that goes from nobody cares to,
World War III
or major disaster. They're like in the middle. The product kind of doesn't work. Customers won't be happy. And at one point I said, if we score everything a 6, given that big scale, it makes sense given this, generic scale we're starting with. Then severity kind of washes out of our ability to influence what we're going to go work on.
Yeah, I always look when I see a company that has the same number on severity or occurrence or detection, I want to take a look at their scales and see if the scales make sense. Because what we're trying to do is differentiate risk.
That's right. So in one point they said, no, we got to use that scale. It's kind of corporate policy. All right, well, fine. Is there a 6 that's higher than that 6, in our discussions, that's closer to a 7 and this one's closer to a 5. So we started doing 6.1, 6.2, 6.8. We put a decimal point behind it. But it was with that idea that the scale has to help us differentiate things. And then we circle back and say, now, is this 6 the same as the 6 that you said earlier? Or is this this sounds more like the 3 you guys scored it earlier. Let's put some notes on our scale of how we're assigning these numbers. And so whether it's severity or occurrence or whatever, is oftentimes the team calibrates to, well, this is how we're defining 2. This is how we're defining a 7. But I think the point you made, Carlo, it's for this FMEA. Right.
Yeah, the FME standards have always said that the scales are modifiable, tailorable to the company.
Mm-hmm. Well, except for that, the AIAG one. I remember that one when I think it first came out. It might have been before you worked on it. The idea was to have a single set of scales so you could roll up all of the suppliers' FMEAs into a vehicle one, and the scores would be comparable. Well, it turned out that almost everybody's FMEA was such a low failure rate that the occurrence ratings all just kind of became ones.
So it really isn't adding value.
Right.
If you can't differentiate risk, then the risk assessment doesn't add value. So I want to disrupt that. And of course, that's the new word now. We're going to disrupt things.
Okay.
And I want to disrupt the company policy. And I want to get scales that make sense, that do differentiate risk, yep. and put that on the table and not adhere blindly to a scale that doesn't add value.
Right. So now if you do that, right, if the scale helps us separate the severity, the occurrence, and detectability elements of what we're exploring, then the resulting number, the multiplication of those three numbers, might be in the range of our hundreds might be important, or the range in the 500s might be important, or the range in the thousands might be important. It's that there's no cutoff then to say, oh, we only do RPNs that are above 300.
Yeah,
let's make sense then.
Let's dispose of two things, first of all, because I know we have limited time on a podcast timing. First disposition is RPN thresholds do not add value. I do not want to advise companies to use RPN thresholds. By threshold, I mean over this RPN means you automatically do something, under it means you don't. That is a wrong approach and can result in numbers games and can result in not resolving risks that you need to resolve. So that's the first thing, is mm-hmm. to not use RPN thresholds. The second thing is that high severity, regardless of RPN, needs to be addressed. And so you get, if you have a high severity and there's risk of safety issues and people getting hurt, that type of thing, even very low occurrence can be an issue with companies. And so where I have a high severity, I want to address that first and get the occurrence as low as possible, get the detection risk as low as possible. Then I can open up and start looking at RPNs in general.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally agree. And now the use of the RPNs, one of them is just calculated. And understanding if the scales are variable as you go into your particular discussion, then the cutoff value just is mute at that point. Now, the other way I've seen it used is they say, all right, we're going to run out the scores and let's look at the safety ones first, the high severity ones. Let's not, if everything's not going to cause major problems. Then it's just start at the top and work your way down. Now, one thing I often advise is that you also look for clusters of things. There might be things that are lower in the overall scale, but one solution would knock out five or six lines. And then in aggregate, you're addressing a lot of different issues. Is there a way to score a cluster of things so that they get more attention, or is it just a scan of this thing of your discussion and say, if we fix the power supply, we deal with 20 of these mid-level problems and it's not expensive. Let's do that.
Yeah, there are some nice ways to plot out and visually represent the risks so you can discover opportunities like that. Mm. I use ReliaSoft's XFMEA because I want to use a relational database and have all the information in one place, all mm-hmm. the different FMEAs in one place, and I can look for groupings of failures, groupings of risk rankings to get the biggest bang for the buck.
Now, is that using something like a hazard analysis where you have the severity and occurrence on the XY axis and in a plot of that, or
That's one of the plots. Okay. Absolutely, that's a great plot. You can plot S and O. S is the Y axis, and O is the X axis. You can plot S times O times other things. In other words, there's lots of different ways you can plot it. But if you have good software, it makes it very easy. Mm-hmm. And you have those plots are pre-programmed in, and so you hit the button and look at the information that way. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I want to clarify one thing, though. When I talk about modifying scales, I don't mean that every FMEA team just invents the scale. I want to have a company-wide discussion about what makes for a good design severity scale, what makes for a good design occurrence scale, what makes for good manufacturing severity, this type mm-hmm, of thing, mm-hmm. and try to get them common for at least a division within a company.
Well, that helps just with the startup. You don't have to re-educate everybody every time, or you're not inventing mm-hmm. the wheel as you go. It is a pretty, it's a set of guidelines or standards helps with the start the discussion. Yet, if everything's a six, that's an indication you need to change the scale.
Absolutely.
Right. If you're, and I've had some teams that, you know, we start with the corporate 10-point scale, and they quickly realize that they're only using the even numbers. So it's effectively a 5-point scale. That's okay.
Yeah. And I write in my book, Fred, that use the smallest number of gradations in the scale that differentiate the risk that needs to be differentiated. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Some very good companies, and I won't bring up names here because it's proprietary, but some very good companies use 1 to 5 on each of the 3 types of risk. And some very good companies use 1 to 10. And so it really, I try to get the fewest number of gradations that differentiate the risk the way it needs to be differentiated.
Well, and it's also a balance of, you don't want to spend a bunch of time sorting out, is it a 2 or a 3, when you've got 6 of them already that are in the 8s and 9s, right?
Yeah.
The discussion is not going to be helpful on the subtle differences of things that are eventually just not going to matter. And that's a hard part of the facilitating is that engineers love these discussions. Hey, he said a 4. I think it's a 7. You might need to spend a little time understanding that. What information do they both bring into this? Let's put it.
Right.
But at some point, you just got to say, all right, let's use the high score and put an asterisk on it. It's something we need to evaluate more. There's more information here. So by leaving it at the high number, it may percolate to the top that we're going to spend time figuring out an action item on it. But the action item might be, what's its real score?
Right.
Right?
Right. Sure. I just want to bring up 2 things that relate to this, so what you're talking about here. Number one is some companies use S&O only.
Right. And I've seen that in safety systems, and there's some of the safety standards call for hazards analysis, which really only uses severity and occurrence. That's kind of the way I've understood that. But it can be done as an FMEA only, too.
Yes, it can be. So I'm going to say about 1/3 of the companies that I work with use S&O. Either they're mandated or it's their choice. Mm-hmm. But where they use S&O without detection risk, I always ask them, I always say you need to take into account somehow the risk that you're incurring through good detection methods or bad detection methods, because there still is risk that relates to detection. Mm-hmm. The best way that I've seen, Fred, on differentiating risk is not the RPN number. It's by taking S, O, and D separately and different combinations and assigning like a red, yellow, green or a variable scale to it and say, this combination is we're considering green, this combination we're considering yellow, this combination we're considering red, or that type of thing, as opposed to a single number representing all the variable risk. That's probably the biggest takeaway from this conversation is one number cannot do it.
Yeah. Well, it's what we do in the severity one by, it's in most of the standards. If you've got a high severity issues, those safety issues, you got to deal with it. Right. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty common sense for most teams that we got to deal with that. But if something occurs every single day and it has a very high occurrence rating, well, it doesn't really matter if it's a low severe, if it's quick to fix and it's, you know, it's not going to take down the system. But when you think about customer satisfaction, I don't want to be fixing this every day.
Exactly. Exactly. So it might be a degradation of performance on a scale of 1 to 10. That would be a 7, or a degradation of a secondary function, which would be a 5. But if it occurs a lot, then absolutely it needs to be dealt with.
Yeah, so you can set, and again, it depends on what's important to your customers, what's important to the success of your program. And so those scales can inform that and not just run out the numbers, RPNs, and be a slave to that scoring. This is a tool to let you look at your information in a number of different ways, right? No pun intended. But we can, I like the idea of using these separate scales and saying, you know, if it's a high severity, we got to deal with it. All right, we got that. If it's a high occurrence rating, well, does this affect customer satisfaction? Okay, then you might add filters to it of where you score these things, and mm-hmm. and take action on them. How about using the RPNs to do the easy things to fix? You know.
Sure. There's low hanging fruit. In other words. There may be a moderate RPN, maybe a degradation of performance on severity and a moderate occurrence, and it's a very low cost issue. By all means. So that's why I don't want to use thresholds. Thresholds get into numbers games. We used to use RPN thresholds with suppliers.
Right.
And if your FMEA has a RPN greater than 80 or some number, and boy, sure enough.
79s. A lot of 79s.
They would get underneath that threshold all the time.
Yeah.
So that's why I definitely don't want to use thresholds, and I definitely want the risk priority numbers and the severity occurrence detection to be used to prioritize risk, not as some objective, if this happens, then you do this automatically.
That's right.
And I like to bring high risk to management.
Yeah, definitely.
From an FMEA.
Yeah. You got to keep them out of the game of plausible deniability.
You're
aware. I told you on June 2nd.
Yeah.
Here's the document. You signed it. mm-hmm. You're on the hook, guy. And now it becomes they need to do something about it, especially the high risk, the safety type stuff. Hopefully your management supports your overall efforts, so you don't have to put them on the spot like that. But it's the communication, I think, needs to happen. That might be a topic for a whole nother podcast. Is when do you tell your boss the bad news that if they don't deal with it, they're going to jail?
That is a good topic. Maybe keep the jail word out of it, but although that can happen.
That
sure.
can happen. It's not. Yes. It's rare, but it does happen.
mm-hmm.
Now, one of the things I want to mention is that Carl, you've just started adding a bunch of these articles. So if our podcast listeners have the chance and they want to dive into these topics in more depth, Carl has started a series of articles on Ascendo Reliability, ACCENDO Reliability.com, called Effective FMEAs. And Carl, why don't you describe the sequence you've got in mind of how you're breaking out these articles and
sure.
covering stuff?
Sure. Each article is going to be a few pages long. In other words, it's not going to be a book that you have to read or a full chapter. So it's a chunk of time that's fairly manageable with people. And we're going to move through the introduction series, which is talking about FMEA in general and the underlying philosophy for good FMEAs and the success factors. Then we're going to move through fundamentals, and we'll talk about each of the elements of FMEA functions, failure modes, effects, causes, etc., severity, occurrence, detection, the different elements of FMEA. But I'm going to do it so that a brand new person can get something out of the article as well as an experienced practitioner. So I'm trying to provide something of value for the new person, the moderate experience, and the experienced person. And then I'm breaking each subject into three elements or three parts. One is the content, the basics, the fundamentals. Number two is problems and solutions that relate to that particular subject so that people can test their knowledge. And then the third thing is intermittently, I'm going to bring in every three articles an actual reader question on the subject of FMEA along with my answer. And so we have this cadence going on of content, problem solutions, reader question, answer, back to another content, and it goes through the whole subject of FMEA, moving through the different series like fundamentals and then into what I call preparation series, which is how do you prepare, how to do P diagrams, how to do block diagrams, and then I move into other subjects like how do you audit FMEAs and then special topics that related to FMEA.
Yeah, and I'm excited because it's going to cover the wealth of information that you have, Carl, in experience with it is coming through in these articles. And the best part, I think, is that it's a vehicle for people to ask questions. So whether it's back through the reliability.fm, asking us questions back to the podcast, or going to the Ascendo Reliability site and adding comments and or sending Carl a message to say, hey, you know, what about this part or what's this question? We certainly can learn. And your questions help us then to steer the future podcasts and steer the future of the articles and keep that discussion going. It's a wonderful tool when it's used correctly, when it's used well. And it can create great value. So take advantage of learning the ins and outs and the nuances of this. Every article I've seen so far is I picked up something new. And it's just like these discussions we had today and the other one. It's just, you know, just thinking about it and thinking about a couple different ways and what are the best practices and how can I apply that will all help you achieve the results you're looking for with your reliability program. And that's the whole idea. All right. So we look forward to your comments. Thanks so much, Carl, for another discussion on FMEA. We'll come back to these topics. I'm sure we've got plenty of others we want to talk about. But I think we'll wrap this one up as it is, and we'll move forward with our rest of our days.
All right. Thanks, Fred.
All right. Take care, Carl. We'll talk to you later.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.